Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston, and today I'm joined by my colleagues Margaret Harris, Mateen Durrani, and Tammy Freeman for a lively chat about the week in physics. We also have a guest appearance by Ginestra Bianconi, who is an Italian physicist and mathematician who studies complexity. Also coming up, we'll talk about the pressing need for standards when it comes to products that purport to benefit from graphene. And we'll chat about the growing role of artificial intelligence in medical physics and beyond. But first, Margaret and Mateen are here to talk about a breakthrough in molecular spectroscopy.
Hi, Hamish.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, we're talking about an article, Margaret, that you wrote on the website called Infrared Spectroscopy Reveals Molecular Fingerprints. Now, infrared spectroscopy provides a powerful way of identifying and characterizing molecules by measuring how they vibrate. So exactly how does it work, Margaret?
Well, Hamish, we all know that if you shine infrared light at something, it heats up. On a microscopic level, that means that its atoms and molecules have absorbed some energy and they're now moving faster, which in a solid means they're vibrating. But a given molecule doesn't absorb all frequencies of infrared light. It only absorbs some of them. The particular frequencies it absorbs will depend on its molecular structure and its environment. So you can say that the absorption acts like a molecular fingerprint, telling you what that molecule is.
Now, normally, as you say, the technique focuses on absorption, but this latest work looks at how that absorbed energy is dissipated and extracts some interesting information out of that.
Yeah, well, I said the light gets absorbed, but of course it doesn't stay absorbed. It dissipates into the environment as vibrations. And what the scientists in this research have done, I should mention they're mostly based in Garching, Germany, in the research group of Ferenc Krauss. What they've done is to detect those vibrations, which are at the same frequency as the absorbed light. You know, what goes in must come out. They call the technique field-resolved infrared spectroscopy.
And what are the main benefits of doing this?
Well, one of the benefits, as I learned when I was talking to Joachim Pupesa about this story, this is the lead researcher on the paper. One of the benefits is that it reduces the background noise because the vibrations, which is what you might call the interesting photons, the signal you want to look at, they get emitted after the excitation pulse is passed. So you don't have your signal riding on top of this much more powerful excitation pulse, which is good because that can create complications for detecting the signal. The other good thing is that because the researchers are looking for vibrations that are in phase with their detection pulse, which they shine onto the sample, they can filter out the thermal vibrations you get from any sort of material that's just not at absolute zero, that is the black body radiation that anything does when it's just sort of sitting there radiating. But maybe the biggest benefit is that you can do this kind of infrared spectroscopy on samples that are either suspended in water, so think living cells in an aqueous solution, or samples that have lots of water in them, like the researchers tried a leaf. So water is a complete killer for infrared absorption spectroscopy because water is really good at absorbing infrared light. I'm kind of playing fast and loose with microscopic and macroscopic properties here, but we all know that water is really good at retaining heat, and the two things are linked. So if you shine infrared light on a sample that in water, what you'll see out the other end isn't a nice, well-defined series of dips at certain frequencies that you can match to the behavior of a known substance. What you see is basically total darkness because the water absorbed all the light. Mateen, I think this is something you know about.
Yeah, back ages ago in the 90s when I was doing my PhD, Hamish, we used to use infrared spectroscopy a lot, and we used to study samples of aqueous solutions with polymers in them. And we actually used a technique called Fourier transform infrared microscopy, where you have an optical microscope and you put a slide on it and you look at the sample with optical light, then you sort of press a big lever and you switch to infrared mode and you look at the spectrum. And the problem is, as Margaret says, there's so much water in the sample and in the air that the infrared, it gets completely absorbed and all the fingerprints from the sample are gone, or large parts of them. And you have to sort of do a complicated subtraction of the background and it all gets really messy. And I remember with my PhD was this microscope, and actually I had to go down to the workshop and build a giant Perspex box, which I put round this whole microscope encasing in a huge plastic box and then basically pump, I think it was nitrogen gas, into the big sample chamber to get rid of all the air. And of course, you could never do it properly, and it would take absolutely ages to clear all the air out. And so water was a real killer.
So it's just the humidity in the air.
Humidity in the air. Wow. Would, because if you're using an infrared, it was this Fourier transform infrared spectrometer, so the light went through the microscope, then it went into a sort of box where it went and was split up by a beam split. And all the time while it's doing that, it's passing through air. So we had to pump it all out and get rid of all the air. And it was, I mean, I did get results. My two fantastic papers are somewhere in the internet. But, you know, it was complicated. And, you know, this technique sounds fascinating. That, I mean, I don't know how long it will be before, you know, it'll become a regular tool. And, you know, when commercial suppliers might start building this, that's a very different question. I'd be interested to know that.
Well, I think that, I mean, that is absolutely the important question. Once you've done something in principle in the lab, can you then do it reliably every time with people who aren't experts and who don't want to build a perspex box around it to keep it running properly? Interestingly enough, you know, it won't surprise you to hear that commercial Fourier transform infrared spectrometers.
That's right.
FTIR. Yeah. They've come along a long way since the 1990s. But in terms of, you know, being, I think they're often cooled to reduce the vibrations from this thermal background. But the researchers in this case tested their method against commercial FTIR devices and found that they were up to, you know, sort of 40 times more sensitive to trace concentrations of materials.
Wow, 40 times.
Yeah,
wow.
40 times or more in some cases. They think it might be able to up to sort of two orders of magnitude more sensitive in some circumstances.
Wow.
There's probably lots of improvements to come as they, you know, sort of work on this technology.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be an interesting story to follow in the coming years.
Is there any IP involved in it, you know, patent rights, or are they, is this just pure research, Margaret?
It wasn't mentioned in the paper. You'd have to speak to the researchers about that, but I'm guessing that, you know, this is very early stage, but at some point, you know, if this technique is as useful as they say it is, and as you seem to say it is in terms of being able to deal with samples and water, I think we can probably say that someone at some point will try to commercialize it, yeah.
I mean, I find it interesting, just simply the physics of it, that you can gain information from those vibrations, not just the typical absorption of the light. That seems really, really interesting to me.
Well, that's been made possible by the development of this really ultra-fast laser, which is something I didn't mention. They have to have a very, very short laser pulse on the molecules so that the pulse has already passed by the before the molecules finish vibrating, so that they can distinguish the initial sort of excitation signal from this vibrational signal. So again, it's a case of better equipment makes it possible to do physics you couldn't do before.
And was I right? You said the process happens within two light pulses, so literally
two oscillations of the
crest,
light field.
Crest,
yeah.
Trough,
yeah.
Crest, trough,
yeah.
And within that time,
yeah.
Incredibly short time, you
yeah.
get the information. Wow.
Yeah, really exciting technique.
Well, that's great. Thanks, Margaret. And Margaret will be back later to talk about graphene. Now, in a week that's seen dramatic headlines about the spread of the dangerous coronavirus in China, it's timely that IOP Publishing, which publishes Physics World, is launching a new journal called the Journal of Physics Complexity. That's because the spread of viruses between individuals is one example of a real-world problem that can be modeled using the techniques and principles of complexity science. To find out more about the field of complexity science, Mateen recently spoke to the physicist-turned-mathematician Ginestra Bianconi from Queen Mary, University of London, who's editor-in-chief of the new journal.
Okay, so hi, Ginestra, how are you?
Fine,
yeah.
Thank you.
So I checked your CV before you came in the building, and it says you originally started studying physics in Rome. So what got you first interested in physics?
Yes, so as a child, I was always fascinated by maths. And actually, more than fascinated, I found it easy.
Oh, that's good.
And then I studied maths, not like the popular book on maths or on physics, but just the next thing in the high school curricula.
Yeah.
And it was like a hobby for me. But then when I needed to choose the university topic, I was undecided between maths and physics because I was very scared about the abstraction of math. And so I chose physics, and then I was very happy with that. And I got wonderful professors, and I was really happy to find the application, to find the nature behind the mathematics.
Right, so physics was more rooted in reality, so that attracted you more.
Yes, yes.
So then you studied at Rome, and then where did your career go next after? Did you went to America for a bit?
Yes. So I did several trips back and forth through the ocean. I was in the States in total, I think, more than 6 years. But this was in two steps.
Right.
So I think that science is principally an exciting journey through intellectual landscape.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then really this also is reflected by traveling physically around the world.
Yeah.
And actually, my first trip to the States was very important because I got exposed to network theory, and it was the beginning of the field. And I was doing my PhD with Laszlo Barabasi, which mm-hmm. really changed dramatically the way in which I do science, I think. And it was very new field.
So that was Alberto Barabasi, and he was, I remember when we had Physics World's 25th anniversary, we picked him as one of our leading lights in physics because of the impact he had.
Yes, Laszlo Barabasi. Yeah.
Laszlo, and then now you moved to London, you're at Queen Mary?
Yes, since 7 years I'm in Queen Mary, and I moved from physics to maths.
Back to maths.
Applied maths. Okay. So always doing complexity, essentially, and always very close to my physics roots. So I find my way between mathematics and physics in Queen Mary.
Okay, and so now you're chief editor of Journal of Physics Complexity, which is published by IAP Publishing, who publishes Physics World. So do you want to remind us about what complexity is? Where does it appear in physics? Complex networks, where are they in physics?
So complex systems are systems that are found everywhere in the natural world, from the brain to the cell to and also in behind the physical world, to social science and infrastructure. But I think they have complexity as a true root in physics and in statistical mechanics, because it speaks about emergent phenomena. So phenomena which are observed in many body system, where the macroscopic collective behavior is not reducible to the elementary parts. And this is really like the starting point of statistical mechanics, you know, and the new evolution from thermodynamics to complex systems. And of course, it is nowadays a truly interdisciplinary topics, which span across many different disciplines. But I think it is important to keep a quantitative aspect of in the study of complex systems. So this J-fix complexity should be seen as a signature of physics, yes, but in general, more general terms of quantitative kind of research systems.
So in terms of being a researcher in complex systems, what kind of mindset does it take? What sort of skills do you need? I mean, obviously, you said your background was in mathematics, and What skills do you need as a physicist to work in that area?
So actually, my background is physics.
Yeah.
It's just that
your original love was mathematics.
I like in complex systems the quite disruptive point of view respect to traditional disciplines. I mean, you are always faced with data which are typically discrete, which are typically stochastic, noisy, and you have to deal with this complexity that is present in the data. And I think from the physics perspective, this, and from the statistical mechanics perspective, this is a bit the opposite of how thermodynamics has evolved. You know, in thermodynamics, in the Industrial Revolution, first, the thermodynamics law were formulated, the macroscopic law, and then statistical mechanics building the microscopic understanding of where this macroscopic law originates. But now in complexity, and we have the opposite problem, that we have a lot of microscopic data about how people interact in all possible ways, in how molecules interact in the cell, but we find very difficult to try to describe this system with the macroscopic law, which will be the thermodynamics in some sense of complex systems.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you can apply, some complex systems include people, and that's quite interesting. That must be help you with sort of outreach work, because there must be lots of good examples of complexity applied to humans.
Yes. I mean, in computational social science, there is a lot of complexity. For instance, I work on a subject which is multilayer network, which has wide application across the complexity subject and application, and also a lot in social science. So this is where you want to distinguish between social types of different nature, and then you just give practically a color or a different connotation to different type of interaction. And this is the same tool, the same physical or mathematical tool or quantitative tool that you use, for instance, in the cell when you want to describe all the type of interaction present in the constituent of a cell. You have protein to protein interaction, you have transcription networks, and you want to go behind the single network picture and understand the whole set of interaction in the cell, which have different connotations.
So it sounds pretty complex. And what are the big challenges for physicists, or what are the big unanswered questions in the field?
Okay, so I think there are several challenges. I think the most pressing one is to turn complexity in a very predictive science. Traditionally, complexity is more of a descriptive type of
describing phenomena,
describing complex systems. And now I think with the merging of tools between complexity and machine learning, we can really hope to turn this into more predictive tools.
Right.
And for instance, this would be very important for prediction of climate change or prediction of epidemic spreading. And also, ideally, you know, understanding of the of the origin of complex disease, both for brain and for complex disease.
Mm. So I remember reading one study which looked at how flu viruses spread by people going to the doctors, and that was quite interesting about monitoring the peak in the pandemic and when you're trying to predict when that might happen. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yes, yes. Now I think this kind of prediction are really becoming very good at predicting the peaks of the epidemics, and people speak about the kind of weather equivalent of a weather forecast for epidemic spreading. So there are many strong computational tools which use at the same time computational tool and analytical model. They include analytical model to predict the outcome and the timing of the epidemics.
Mm, so really sort of practical application of that. Okay, so before we go, I mentioned that you're chief editor of Journal of Physics Complexity. So before you go, a quick plug, why should people write for the journal? Why will it be relevant to physicists?
Well, because complexity is everywhere, from the biological world to social science. And we really need new quantitative methods to tackle this question and to solve long-standing problems that are in complexity. So also to have a very important impact in the society and in the future of our world.
Right. When are the first papers coming out? Have they been published yet?
I think beginning of next year.
2020. Right. Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. Well, I look forward to that, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So that was Mateen speaking with Ginestra Bianconi from Queen Mary, University of London. She's the new editor-in-chief of the Journal of Physics Complexity. And since that interview was recorded, there's been a slight delay in when the first papers in the journal will appear. They're now due out in March. Visit iopscience.iop.org for more information. Now I'm joined by Tammy to chat about the rise of the use of artificial intelligence in medical physics. Hi, Tammy.
Hi.
Now this week we reported on two advances in medical physics that involve artificial intelligence. One is headlined, Raman Imaging plus AI Classifies Brain Cancers During Surgery. And it looks at a proposed way of reducing delays that can arise when tissue removed by a surgeon is analyzed to guide how the rest of the operation to proceed. So how do things currently work?
Well, at the moment, a sample of tumor tissue is removed during surgery. And then typically this tissue sample is taken to a laboratory, it's processed and prepared by skilled technicians, and then interpreted by a pathologist. And this happens while the patient and the surgical team are waiting in the operating theatre and can take around 20 to 30 minutes. Another problem with this approach, apart from the time it takes, is there's actually a bit of a global shortage of pathologists to provide such diagnoses.
So it would be great if this time could be cut down.
Indeed.
And that's where our artificial intelligence comes in. So what's been developed?
Okay, so there's two parts to this new approach, which was developed by a team led by neurosurgeon Daniel Oringer at NYU Langone. So the first is the use of stimulated Raman histology. And this is a laser-based technique that creates high-resolution images of unprocessed tissue. And it detects tissue components such as lipids and proteins, and it can use these as diagnostic features. So the next part is the team needed a way to quickly analyse these Raman findings and to potentially classify brain tumours. And it was here that they investigated the use of artificial intelligence. So what they did, the team trained a deep convolutional neural network using these stimulated Raman histology images. And they used images from more than 2.5 million samples from patients. And they trained it to classify tissues into 13 categories based on the most common brain tumours and to offer a diagnostic prediction. They then tested their system on 278 brain tumour biopsies, and they also sent the same samples for pathology diagnosis. Now, the AI system, it did really well. It classified 94.6% of the tumours correctly, and the pathologists achieved 93.9%. So pretty similar performance. But the important thing is the Raman plus AI approach was really fast. It could classify brain tumor type in less than 150 seconds. So that's a big advantage, like compared with 20 to 30 minutes.
Yeah, because I know that if I was having brain surgery, I don't think I'd want to be. Well, I wouldn't know, I suppose, but I don't think I'd want to be lying there for 20 minutes.
No, faster's definitely
And I'm sure
better.
The surgeons really like this as well. And this is something that can be done in theater. So the Raman technique would be done right then and there. And
yes, in
the
situ,
computer would
yeah.
be there. Wow, that's amazing. And we also have a story about using AI to predict the recurrence of prostate cancer after surgery. And I think this is sort of a similar idea, using AI to look at pathology samples.
Yeah, exactly. So here, researchers from Riken in Japan developed an AI framework that can identify features in pathology images and make these features so that they can be understood by doctors. So what they did was they used pathology images from around 850 patients, and they took the first 100 images and used them to train two unsupervised deep neural networks and to train these to reduce a massive amount of data down to just 100 features. They then verified the ability of these features to predict cancer recurrence, and they tested it on the remaining images in the data set. And what they found was that the features discovered by the AI method were more accurate than predictions made by pathologists who use the Gleason score, which is a gold standard method for determining the aggressiveness of prostate cancer. So this is another example of AI helping with cancer diagnosis. And you can read more in the article, which is called Opening the AI Box: Can Deep Learning Predict Cancer Recurrence? And also, Hamish, we have a third AI story this week, but this one's in the field of nanophotonics.
That's right. Yeah, this has nothing to do with medical physics. Well, at the moment, possibly there might be some medical physics applications down the road. And this is an article by our regular contributor, Sam Jarman, and it's called Artificial Intelligence Reveals How Light Flows Around Nanoparticles. And it describes how researchers at the University of Southampton in the UK have trained an AI system to predict how light will interact with nanostructures that are smaller than the actual wavelength of the light itself.
That sounds like a difficult thing to do.
It is. I mean, in principle, all you have to do, is solve Maxwell's equations, because that will give you the answer. But that can be very computationally intensive and also time-consuming to do. So what the Southampton researchers have done is create an AI system that can be taught the essential aspects of how light interacts with matter. And the system then uses this knowledge to predict how light will flow around a specific 3D object. And it does this without having to solve Maxwell's equations. I think the way that it works is, you know, sort of the wisdom or of Maxwell's equations are sort of input into the system.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just uses that knowledge to predict an output. So yeah, it sounds like a very clever way of dealing with what is a tough problem in nanophotonics.
And I presume it does this quite much faster than previous.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's very fast. Yeah, yeah, and there's some other benefits as well. The big benefit, according to the researchers, is that the technique could be used to do inverse design. And that's where, you know, you say, well, I want a system that has certain optical properties. What should that system look like? And apparently, you know, a next step in developing this AI would be to incorporate inverse design. And that would make it a very powerful tool for designing components for a wide range of applications, including all optical computers.
Okay. And maybe medical applications one day.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there are, you know, a lot of potential medical applications for nanophotonics.
Mm.
So, yeah, definitely watch this spot. Thanks, Tammy. Now, Margaret and Mateen are back. to chat about a very popular blog that Margaret's written this week. Now, Margaret, this blog, it follows on from your review of a pair of graphene headphones. And in your latest blog, you address the pressing question of how to judge whether the presence of graphene in a product actually enhances its performance or is purely cosmetic for marketing reasons. And I think the blog was inspired by correspondence that you had with readers about your headphones review. What sort of things were you chatting with people about?
Well, yeah, as I said, regular listeners to the podcast may remember that I talked about these graphene headphones a couple of weeks ago. And since then, I had a couple of messages either from readers of the website or from listeners to this podcast about other headphones that they'd seen that also contained graphene. And, you know, some people were singing the praises of these other graphene headphones that they own, and others were asking more skeptically whether the graphene is just a gimmick, like the marketing equivalent of clickbait. So what I try to do in my blog is to address this with the gigantic caveat that I can't make a judgment on the quality of any product I haven't personally tried. And I also can't tell you whether a product actually contains graphene or not without sending it to a proper testing lab, which unfortunately the Physics World offices lacks.
I mean, it is a tricky one because I think, you know, in the case of the headphones, you know, you do point out that headphones sound good for any number of reasons.
Oh, yeah. It
might have nothing to do with graphene or everything to do with graphene.
Absolutely. That's another really important caveat. But another point that is that I tried to make is that even within the scientific and technical community, graphene means different things to different people. So I tried to define, and I may get some stick for this, a sort of rough and ready shorthand for those different meanings. Because so to many physicists, graphene is this ultra pure, single layer, completely two-dimensional form of carbon, and it has these amazing electronic properties, which we've talked about a lot and written about a lot on the website because there's loads of research going on about it. To materials scientists, however, graphene is this maybe few layer kind of pure form of carbon that still has some really amazing mechanical properties. It's strong and it's stiff and it's pretty amazing stuff. And then to engineers, graphene is maybe just a really extra good form of graphite that has maybe up to as many as 100 layers of carbon in it. And you can put it into paint or resin to make it conduct heat better and maybe conduct electricity better, which is important for resisting corrosion. So here we have physicist graphene, materials scientist graphene, and engineers graphene. These are three different things. They're all very useful and cool. I'm not trying to start a fight here between physicists, materials scientists, and engineers, but they do all have different price points and different properties.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting distinction because, you know, as someone who falls in the physicist camp, whenever someone says graphene to me, I think of, electrons moving really quickly through a material or making a graphene transistor or those sorts of things. You know, it's a very sort of physics-y thing to me. But I could understand why people in other disciplines would see graphene as being very different.
And I think I've written a lot about some of the more applied end of graphene. So I probably think of it, okay, yeah, it's kind of in the back of my mind that it's this really, you know, ultra pure single layer stuff, but it's really difficult to make that type of graphene. So the applications we're seeing at the moment, loads of uses for engineers graphene and materials scientists graphene, not yet, and mostly on the research level, uses for the physicist type of graphene.
I mean, the thing about the graphene is that, first of all, the people who discovered it won a Nobel Prize for Physics, and it has that kudos to it that other materials probably don't. And the second reason, it's not really a trademark name, so anybody can say graphene to refer to anything without. I mean, yeah. How do you know that you've what kind of graphene? And I know I visited the National Physical Laboratory and in Teddington near London, and people there are trying to produce standards for graphene. But, you know, for the time being, it's a kind of marketing person's dream that they can bandy that name about with no one really knowing what it is. And one of the examples that you showed me earlier today, Margaret, was a graphene headphone where literally they just sprayed on a load of graphene onto some part of the device. Whether it was any use or not, I don't know, but they could claim there's graphene in it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a pure selling point, even though in terms of oral quality, may make not much difference.
Yeah, it may not. And I haven't tried a pair of graphene headphones of that type of manufacturer, so I really can't say anything about how good they may or may not sound. But I do know I was the manufacturer that made the graphene headphones I did try has someone from there has since sent me a research paper. Well, it's not a peer-reviewed paper, but it's a paper in a trade magazine for the loudspeaker industry, as it happens. And this paper has been written by Robert Eric Gaskell, who is the co-founder of Aura, which made these graphene headphones that I reviewed. So obviously the author has an interest in the particular way that they're using graphene, which isn't sprayed onto a surface. It's they're actually made a substance that is graphene standalone headphones. But apart from that, some of the things he says really resonated with what I've seen elsewhere and what you've seen elsewhere in the graphene industry with your visit to the National Physical Laboratory. And this is not just in headphones, but generally. One thing that Gaskell says is that history will likely look back at this period as the quote-unquote Wild West of graphene commercialization. There are currently no regulations or standards insofar as what can be marketed as graphene. And then he goes on to say, well, I really love this phrase, that simply sprinkling some graphene on top is not sufficient to take advantage of this wonder material.
Because I remember I mentioned on the podcast a few weeks ago that there was that graphene tennis racket in 2013 that Andy Murray used. And I was told at this big conference in London that the graphene helped to affect the mass distribution in the rackets. Mm. So the racket wasn't made of graphene, it was made of normal.
Yeah, it probably had some graphene in it, and this engineer's graphene, as I said.
Somehow it helped them to distribute the mass of the racket so that it was more, I think, at the in the handle or the tip, I can't remember. But since then, I said to you, Margaret, there's been a hockey stick made of graphene, which, you know, who knows what is in that and how much difference it makes.
Yep, and so, there's graphene tennis shoes and there's graphene underwear, which I'm definitely not going to be testing in the office. I don't think anybody wants to hear my opinion about graphene underwear or yours or Hamish's. But yeah, you know, these things could contain almost anything. And you know, they may well contain graphene, but the question is whether that graphene is doing what it's meant to be doing.
Yeah, so definitely a Wild West.
Yes.
But all is not lost, is it? Am I right in thinking that scientists and engineers are actively trying to develop standards and tests, et cetera, for graphene? How is that going?
Well, so in the same article, Gaskell quotes a paper from 2018 in the journal Advanced Materials, which is written, co-authored by one of the co-discoverers of graphene, Kostya Novoselov. And the authors found that the quality of the graphene produced in the world today is rather poor, not optimal for most applications, and most companies are producing graphite microplatelets, which, according to my labeling system, is either engineer graphene or at the very dodgy end of materials scientist graphene. So I think what they've done is really define the problem so far. And defining the problem is, as any researcher knows, the first step to solving it. So they're developing, you know, better technologies for analyzing what type of graphene there is, because at the moment, if you just look at it by eye, graphene and graphite, they look the same. They're black, gritty powders. You really need much more sophisticated instruments to find out the difference between them. So I think these are some of the things that members of the research and industrial community are both working on.
So do you think that's going to catch on, Margaret? Physicist graphene, engineers graphene, material scientist graphene. I mean, it caught my eye when you mentioned it. I thought it was
the Harris scale of graphene.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe. I mean, there are technical names for these things. So the many layer end is sometimes referred to as graphene nanoplatelets, for example, which still has but it's not as catchy as engineers graphene. I think I kind of like the system.
Yeah, I do. I hope it catches on. Maybe this is the start of something.
All right.
So yes, the Wild West. So I suppose the lesson is if you're thinking of buying something with that's described to contain graphene, you might want to have a close look as to what that graphene actually does, assuming that you can actually evaluate its performance. That's all for this episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. Thanks so much to our special guest, Ginestra Bianconi, and our regulars, Tammy Freeman, Margaret Harris, and Mateen Durrani. And of course, thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. Remember that if you like what you hear, then you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. And we're also on Spotify, so you can follow us there. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week.
Physics World.